Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco to continue our discussion on C.S. Lewis. Last episode, the content of the show was inspired by a new movie, and it's a docudrama about C.S. Lewis' life as a Christian or conversion to Christianity called The Most Reluctant Convert. We used that as a springboard to discuss sort of a biography of Lewis' life and the importance of his works. And we also commented on the quality of the movie, which was good.
Yeah,
and
that's great.
If you can stream that now, because I think it was a very limited release in theaters, I think you would probably enjoy it.
It's streamable now?
I don't know. I think it might be. I have to look into it more. I haven't streamed it because I saw it in a theater, so I will look. But often those things...
You probably have to go in the dark web. Just don't answer your door if there's a knock shortly thereafter.
Right. I mean, I feel like
you were searching for a C.S. Lewis movie.
You know, it's like direct-to-home video is no longer a bad thing, right? That's pretty much...
Well, COVID fixed that.
Yeah, COVID fixed that. It's not about the quality of your movie anymore. So... I remember that, you know, you would get a VHS release of this Disney movie, and then the direct-to-home video movies would all be advertised before the real movie. So now that's standard fare. So
it's amazing to me that you can speak about VHS. I always think of you as a very young person, but apparently you're older than.
They had, in their room when they were a kid, they had a maybe 9 by 9 inch TV with a VHS combo in the TV.
In the TV.
And we had a whole closet full of VHS movies.
There's this, so I'm like the last or second to last year for millennials, which, man, what a great shame on my name to be a millennial. But there's a segment of the younger millennials versus the elder millennials, where we grew up in the transition period between VHS, DVD, and digital, more so. Mm-hmm. So millennials all watched things on VHS. The youngest millennials, you know, like you could go to the store and buy either the VHS or the DVD.
Yeah, I remember that. So, or I remember going to Blockbuster Video.
Yeah.
It's the DVD section. I remember when they
started. My mom worked at a Blockbuster for a little while.
I got banned from Blockbuster. I was bad at turning in movies.
I was going to ask why, but I was a little afraid to know.
No. My wife took me off the account.
Yeah.
That's outstanding.
So last episode, like I was saying, was sort of a general overview of Lewis and Christianity, brought to us by this excellent movie and I think play as well, is my understanding, before it was a movie. From that conversation, as I was going over... listening to that before it went up live, I noticed that the main thing we could elaborate on in the next episode were specific works and specific details of Lewis' life post-Christian. Because I think it would be true to say that his most impactful works, whether they're apologetic, whether they're literary, or sort of literary in the sense of like fiction, or literary in the sense of literary criticism, that they all happen after this conversion, the most influential of his works. Is that fair to say?
It's true, yeah.
So I think we also talked about how the movie in this biography comes out of his own biographies of both his life and the evolution of his ideas. Is that also true?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, Lewis as an author comes into his own as a Christian. And his... In fact, most of his books, nearly all of his books, honestly, are Christian themed, except for a couple. An Experiment in Criticism is actually Lewis's stab at a work that is within the field of his training. So, like, actually, as a literature prof, and then I think Abolition of Man is Christian, but it's more philosophical. Wouldn't you agree, Adam? Yeah.
Yeah, and it, in a way, it's sort of a a defense of Western civilization and its great traditions, right?
Yeah. These days we might say a worldview book.
Yeah, you could call it political theology in a sense as well.
The funny thing about the Abolition of Man is I've listened to lots of lectures on Abolition of Man, and it's funny how many different lenses this can be seen through.
It's actually the one I have a first edition of. So I have a first edition of Abolition of Man.
I think it's I would say it's philosophical arguing for the great Western tradition. I think Adam's on that. Till We Have Faces, I guess, is probably Christian-ish themed. It's the one of Lewis's book that I connect with the absolute least. Till We Have Faces is very often adapted into a play because it's a take on, I forget which classical play, but a classical play. And it's the thing that drives me crazy about it is it's sort of Lewis's Platonism or Neoplatonism kind of gone hog wild, you know, with no curbs put on it at all. As free as it could be. Like the Platonic form of Lewis as a Neoplatonist really makes its emergence Until We Have Faces. But other than that, unless I'm missing something, most of his works beyond that have a very Christian theme to them, and I would say are a result of his Christian conversion.
All right. There is some criticism about that, and I guess we could address the room here about should lay theologians have such a large audience? This was even a critique of sort of his breakthrough in that field is not his field of academic expertise at Oxford, right? But that's what people are going to primarily remember him as, is as a lay theologian.
I'm going to let Adam answer first, and then I have a very, I think, hard answer to this question. So, but Adam, go for it.
Well, is the question, should lay people do theology, kind of?
Should lay people do theology, and should somebody who is not, you know, a quote expert in the field be publicly teaching, not even do theology?
The answer is the lay people on a theology podcast.
But publicly teaching.
Well,
I mean, lay in the broader sense.
I know what you mean.
Can I just say yes? and they always have. In our own tradition, the Lutheran tradition, I mean, one of our great theologians and writer of several of our confessional documents was Philip Melanchthon, a layman, although he's a little different than your ordinary layman, I guess.
There's two ways to take this, right? You could be layman as in not clergy, or layman as in not formally educated in theology at the university.
I mean, with Lewis, if I can't remember exactly where it is, it might be in the preface to What Became Mere Christianity, and Scott, you can correct me, didn't he say the reason why he was doing theology and apologetics because nobody else was, or people were, but they weren't addressing the
problems the of the day.
Person. Yeah. I mean, in many ways, that's the spirit of the Lutheran tradition, right? Luther very, very intentionally, he could mix it up with any scholastic theologian of his day, but he's very intentional in 9 times out of 10 addressing the laity.
Well, academic theology has a tendency to become, after certain periods of time, for each tradition or each group, speculative, right? You sort of run out of, or you get bored with sort of just asserting the truths from Scripture, we'll say, and it starts just becoming a mental exercise for self-enjoyment or sort of promoting abstract ideas.
Yeah.
And you can see that critique in Lewis is like the theologians are busy talking about abstract ideas that no person on the street can relate to or understand at all.
So I've become, and I hope I don't get myself in trouble here a little bit, I've become anti-specialist a little bit. I think one of the big problems that we have with the modern educational system, so even Adam at a liberal arts university, right? Students go there thinking about their specialty and their major, and they think almost primarily about that. And you literally hear comments like, I've got to get this general education out of the way, and then I can do what I really came here to do.
Yep.
And that I mean, if you think that's bad in undergrad, it's worse in master's programs. And if you think it's bad in master's programs, it's worse in PhD programs. And if you think it's bad in PhD programs, it's worse in postdocs. And you can just go on and on and on and on. And one of the great things about C.S. Lewis is he's kind of, even in his own training, he's an anti-specialist. The degree that he took at Oxford, God bless it, was the one that was called the Greats, right? Isn't that what it's called, the Greats? It's sort of a broad education in reading, I guess I'd say. You know, he was educated to be educated. And so it's no surprise that when he dips his toe into the field of writing theology or writing theologically, he ends up being better at it than the people who are specialists in it and have just specialized in that one area and literally can't talk to people broadly anymore because they've only learned how to talk to other theological pointy-headed nerds like them. Lewis was broad, read broadly, read across fields, and in a lot of ways, especially in his training at Oxford, was required to do that, read the classics, knew the classics inside and out. And I think that's another thing that you see in common with, I guess I'd say, lay theologians who end up becoming, you know, theologians and heavy-hitting powerhouses in their field is they often, too, know the classics. Why is it important to know the classics? Because the classics don't just deal with, you know, one topic. When you read classical literature, you could be reading anything from a story of fiction, mm-hmm. to heavy-duty philosophy, to thoughts on the day on history, thoughts on the day in medicine, and the medical practice, thoughts on the day in early what we would call doing of science. This is all contained in what we call the literature of classical antiquity. If you know that well, you know sort of the broad narrative of how humans came to think what they think on topics and how they got there, especially in the Western world. And that's what he knew inside and out. So it's really not surprising when he turned that kind of eye, that dedication to research, to theology, that he became, you know, the best known, quote unquote, theologian of his day while still not being a, quote unquote, theologian.
There's something in our own tradition with this, you know, that Lutheranism has, you know, is buddy-buddy alongside Northern humanism for a good chunk of its development during the Reformation. And the interesting thing about this, especially I think in Luther, is his ability to having a vast knowledge of the classical world, reading it, referencing it constantly, is that it avoids some of the isms, like,
right,
because it's so broad. And if you understand the usefulness of each one, you can actually use them when appropriate, use them, those tools when needed, and sort of leave them behind at important junctures, right? So you can use humanism, but leave it behind. You can use Aristotelian.
Let's do a couple things here. Let's have Adam do it since he's our specialist in history. as I went on my anti-specialist deck there. Can you define for us, Adam, humanism and sort of what the sort of emphasis between, different emphasis between Northern humanism and Southern humanism might be, just in case there's some listeners, like 99.9% of them, who wouldn't know what the heck he was talking about.
What's a Northern humanist?
Well, yeah, how long do we have?
You get 30 seconds for each explanation.
Humanism being very much related to the Renaissance, the late medieval, early modern Renaissance. So you could, you know, people date it differently, but you could say the 1300s, the Renaissance begins in the South, in Italy in particular. And in many ways, it's a rediscovery of classic antiquity. It's not that people weren't reading Plato or Aristotle or, you know, Herodotus or whatever before, but it was pretty few and far between. And at best, by and large, most people were just reading these great authors from antiquity in proof texts from other sources. So you get a guy like Francesca Petrarch is oftentimes called the father of the Renaissance, who who starts reading Cicero in the primary source and gets quite excited about it, so much so that he starts writing letters to Cicero and Homer and kind of, I mean, in from a 21st century chronological snobbish perspective, very strange letters. But it was kind of an intellectual exercise. And so there's in Italy, or the Southern humanism in the Renaissance, there's a rebirth of classic antiquity and a refascination with it. When the Renaissance crosses the Alps and moves into the north, it's a much broader movement, if you will, in that it certainly is attracted to classic antiquity, but it's not really interested in classic antiquity just for the sake of being interested in classic antiquity. It's for, you know, in many ways kind of uses classic antiquity to help rethink what Western civilization might look like. And so there's in the north, there's a concentrated effort at learning the languages of the primary sources for the sake of eloquence and learning grammar and these sorts of things. So in many ways in the north, you could just say humanism is a rebirth or revival of historic learning, whereas in the Middle Ages, we have to be a little careful here lest we turn it into kind of a caricature, but in the Middle Ages, learning, education is very, as you would call it, Scott, specialist. Mm-hmm. It majors and minors. It becomes very speculative. The humanist tradition attempts to sort of bring, to look at humanity, focus on humanity, or refocus on humanity, and have fun while learning, I think you could say. Those humanists certainly had a whole lot of fun, whereas the medieval scholastics, I think it'd be kind of fun to hang out with Thomas Aquinas, but it might be a bit boring after a while when you're arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin for weeks on end, even though that question I don't think ever actually came up in the Middle Ages, but.
Yeah, I mean, the fun thing is interesting. In Luther's Table Talks, you get some of these, like, dialogue between Luther and Melanchthon and other people. And there's one where, you know, Luther's talking about, you know, modern scholastics, so scholastics during the Reformation, saying lots of things but having no substance, and Melanchthon goes, oh, in every age, and he cites some mm-hmm. example from Rome. He goes, there's been somebody long-winded who more beautifully than anybody else says nothing.
That's right.
Right. And the whole thing is he doesn't say who he's quoting, but he's quoting.
So let's take this back to C.S. Lewis, just for the sake of the title of the show.
Yeah.
You could say that in Lewis's time, you know, again, coming out of World War I into World War II, you know, in continental Europe, especially sort of theological traditions, because of the Enlightenment and a lot of reasons that we probably should get into and show that I don't think we've even done, but sort of Protestant liberalism has really made its mark on continental theology during this time period. And you could kind of call those like the scholastics of the 20th century, but so much so that it's, you know, less arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of the pin and more arguing about could the resurrection actually have happened or not, while answering, well, of course not. No way it could have. And then the transition into Neo-Orthodoxy, which, you know, we could debate whether that was a good move or not. But at the same time, two very heady, very specific conversations that only the people in the room are going to understand the conversation. Like you come into an academic lounge and there's a bunch of theologians smoking their pipes, having these conversations. Literally, if you're just like, you know, the window washer walking in from outside to the room and listen to this, you're not going to understand what's going on in that room or what's being said in that room. Lewis, as a quote-unquote theologian, reaction to that is to bring these conversations, redemption, atonement, resurrection, sin, grace, faith, the Trinity, both through literature, works of fictional literature, and through serious prose, into the language of the people that they can understand. That is different than what was going on in his time. among the theologians. Like to say that this nobody was doing this, nobody might be strong, but it's not that strong.
Yeah, in a way, doesn't he act? I mean, I think he even refers to himself as a translator of theology.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Great description.
You know, the theologians, the specialist theologians, are at least they think they're advancing knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know, right. In a very elite club, whereas Lewis, I bet he could mix it up with those theologians. He probably would have found them extremely boring. You know, after about 5 minutes.
And boorish.
Yeah.
He's the one who's going to try to articulate traditional or Orthodox Christian theology for the window washer, or the plumber, or the banker who happens to be interested in history and maybe knows a bit about Augustine or something. Yeah. So it's in a way it's kind of he's very practical in his theology, not in a pastoral sense, but he's just trying to make it understandable.
Yeah, I mean, theology, at least from the Lutheran perspective, is not for intellectual stimulation. It is actually for those people. It's actually supposed to be communicating salvation to people.
But I don't think there was a sense of that in Lewis's time. Neither on the continent, especially not on the continent, nor where he is in Oxford, in England at this time. And so, you know, he's an academic, too. I mean, the funny thing about this is he's an academic. This guy had, by the time he was 13, read more books than any of us will probably ever read in a lifetime, even we educated people. Was very, very fluent in Greek and Latin. I think French as well. A scholar's scholar, and was the one that was able to take this to the people. Mm-hmm. There's something unique about that.
Mm-hmm. So let's...
Last episode, you mentioned his work, Weight of Glory, which is a collection of sermons and essays. And I checked it out of our library because it's been forever since I've looked at it. And in 10 pages, for example, his little essay on called Membership, which is kind of a bit of his political philosophy. Just in 10 pages, he's dropping names of authors from antiquity to the Middle Ages that I've only sort of seen in passing in massive surveys of history. So in many ways, you brought up the question about humanism. You know, 16th century or early modern humanism was kind of like that as well, where they would, you know, Melanchthon and Luther writing back and forth, or the humanists across the continent when they're writing back and forth. In many ways, they're playful with each other, but they're also kind of they're a bit braggadocious, you know, with you know, they're dropping names to kind of
testing each other.
Yeah, but Lewis isn't bragging. This is just Lewis. He lives in the world of ideas. And I would say Lewis, at least one essay I read recently on Lewis as intellectual historian, makes the point, I don't think this is all that controversial, that he does not see himself as a modern man.
No, yes.
He certainly doesn't. He's not some precursor to a postmodern sort of age. But he is intentionally pre-modern in his worldview.
He calls himself a dinosaur. He refers to himself as a dinosaur sometimes.
Well, in his big sort of Luther's Tower moment for Lewis is his realization that he's approaching all of life with chronological snobbery, he calls it, that he was approaching his entire sort of epistemological life with the presupposition that what we know now must be better than what we once knew. And what he found out, and this is what that Hideous Strength is, which is the last, well, not really the last, but the last book in the space trilogy deals with just in spades, Ransom's sort of voyage in that Hideous Strength is a hyperbolic sort of Lewis's voyage in real life, kind of very hyperbolic though, realizing that the knowledge of the past is central who we are in the here and now and can't be out of hand discarded, and that all knowledge needs to be, you know, dealt with, all ideas need to be dealt with skeptically until they can be shown to be worth holding You know, what is it? Skepticism is the chastity of the mind. He very much, you know, that's the approach that you take. That does make one a dinosaur. if you try living your life that way today, be skeptical of what you hear on the old internet, what you hear from government sources, what you hear on the news, what you hear on the radio, and you will be seen as some sort of dinosaur. Well, it was no different in Lewis's time either.
His ultimate post at Cambridge was medieval and Renaissance literature, right? He wanted to lump those things together. So, I mean, it's absolutely fair to say he's totally not ignorant of the recovery of antiquity for thought in the Renaissance and the early Middle Age or the late Middle Ages.
Yeah. No, I think it'd be fair to say he's not ignorant of much thought, you know, that was written down in his time. Philosophy.
But you can see if that era influences
maybe mathematics.
Him.
I'm not sure how he was in mathematics, but he might like the rest of us that, you know, we're liberal arts people, be weak on that point. But
sorry to interrupt, but there's a collection of his, I guess there are more literary essays called Selected Literary Essays, right? And there's his inaugural lecture when he took that chair down at Cambridge. Where he looks at the way historians typically break up history into the ancient, medieval, and modern period. And he says something to the effect of that he was pleased that the name of that chair was medieval and Renaissance literature, because he thought it signified that there is some movement towards breaking down some of those traditional barriers between periods of history. And one of his points in the essay is that not only is all of history connected, but all these great thinkers, whether they're medieval or ancient or early modern, in many ways are all part of one massive conversation.
Right.
If there is one dividing line in history, he says, it's the modern age. So he'll break it down into three periods. There's the pagan age, there's the Christian age, and then there's the post-Christian age. And he says the post-Christian age is much different than, say, the pagan age in its relationship to Christianity.
Or even its relationship to the idea of having knowledge of the spiritual, for lack of a better word.
Oh, yeah. He thinks modernism has, I mean, we talked a bit about this last time, but modernism is destructive. It's the age of machines where we're owned by things we've created. Whereas in the past, like in the pagan age before Christianity, for example, he will say that the difference between pagans and Christians in those two epochs is that they both worship something. It's just they differ on what it is they worship. In the modern age, there is no worship. At best, there's worship of things we've created. It's the great age of idolatry in a way.
Pagans still worshipped gods, you know.
Yeah, but they believe in something higher.
In the modern age, they totally discounted knowledge, especially in his time, discounted, you know, the possibility of having any type of knowledge of the supernatural, shall we say.
Yeah.
The other, the unseen realm.
So I think now would be a good opportunity to just outline some important books. I don't want to assume what people have read, but I do want to assume a couple of things, that most people who are familiar with Lewis are familiar with The Chronicles of Narnia.
Or at least Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe.
At least Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And that probably most people who care about Lewis in any substantial way are aware of Mere Christianity and probably have read it. I would say those are... So, going broader, why go beyond those two? What do you go beyond into? What are sort of also some of the more popular works? And then for you two, and I can answer this if we have time too, what do you think are actually the most impactful if you were going to suggest things to people?
Do you want to go first, Adam?
It's hard to whittle it down.
Well, I pulled a couple off the shelf. I have to say, just because I used it so heavily in my book, Being Dad, I have to use The Four Loves. I mean, this is where Luther goes through the...
Lewis.
Sorry. Did I say Luther?
You said Luther.
They both start with L. That's difficult for me. Lewis goes through the, you know, the four Greek words for love and sort of how they're different and how sort of they impact our lives. And at the end of the day, how Christians encounter them. And it's just, it's a remarkable work, especially in my... my mind, the section on philia for friendship, especially for, you know, the age that we live in. I really think every man should read this because we, you know, everyone claims crisis. I'm not sure I'm going to do that. But we are in a time where men are reporting to have, you know, very few 2-0 friends. And they also at the same time reporting a very high rate of suicidality. And it seems like there's possibly a connection between those two things. And looking at what Lewis says on friendship in the Four Loves, I think could help some people reframe how they think of the importance of the concept and the idea and even the reality of friendship. I think I have a book on that too, where two or three are gathered.
Yes.
People could check that out too.
Edited volume. Don't give people the implication you wrote the whole thing.
Oh my goodness, says somebody with a chapter in the book. So that's a big one. That's a big one for me. It's one I go back to quite a bit. I would say as far as impact, it's not one I go back to that often. I used it when I was teaching the basic theology class at the university, but haven't really gone back to it much since. Is Mere Christianity, which is sort of his, it's kind of his basic work in Christianity, both evangelistic, apologetic, and kind of, I would say, a little bit systematic too. Some of the books sort of really systematically deal with concepts in Christianity. I think people, if they haven't checked that out, they should check it out. And as far as, I'll go into the fiction, we probably already recommended it. I know your favorite on the fiction side is The Great Divorce, Caleb. They're a difficult slog, much harder to read than The Chronicles of Narnia by like orders of magnitude. But I would say the Space Trilogy is a very important read just for the topics that it deals with. If you were just going to pick one book out of there, I think I would pick Paralandra, the second one in the volume, just because of its, I'd say at this point, kind of mythical retelling, possible retelling of the story of the fall. Because if you think of like the brief account of the fall in the first couple chapters of Genesis, it's just really weird that all of a sudden the serpent shows up and they're like, yeah,
talking
this dude must be right. And it's a snake. And all of a sudden they're sinning. Right. Lewis deals with that in sort of a protracted fashion. And again, it's fiction.
Creative speculation
about how such a thing could have happened in like time periods and compression of time periods and how God's laws that seem arbitrary aren't arbitrary and the whole nine yards.
There's something, I don't want to say safe, but it's the only word I can think of about creative speculation versus explicitly theological speculation, because instead of offering an answer in sort of your speculative ideas, it's just trying to provide you some sort of comfort that there may not be an answer but there is one.
Yeah,
somewhere.
Well, I'd say the same thing about two of the books in the Narnia series that are probably dropped off the list when people read them. The Magician's Nephew, maybe not The Last Battle, maybe not dropped off the list in The Last Battle. But what both of those books do for creation and sort of speculative fiction and end times, eschatology.
Yeah, because you want to be careful not to tell people this is the eschaton, right? Or this is creation. But you're also giving somebody something to sort of...
Once you've heard further up and further in, you'll never forget it.
Yeah, well, you're giving some people something to sort of lay their head on when it's bothering them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Once you've pictured Aslan singing the universe into creation, I don't think it's a picture you're going to lose.
Yeah. That's interesting. Adam, you have anything? Or I can talk about... I actually have sort of like a interesting relationship with The Great Divorce and Screwtape in that the reception of them is interesting to me. I think evangelical Christians are usually very aware of The Great Divorce and the Screwtape Letters. And there's two reasons for that. Is that it's very easy for you to just from a non-denominationally Christian perspective, just go, yeah, Christian journey, and this is how the world, the devil, and the sinful flesh challenge me, and sort of just sort of latch onto that. The Great Divorce is interesting because Lewis is intentionally packing something with theological, like, doctrine, while saying, hey, this isn't doctrine. Right, like in the little preface, he's like,
and at the end, waking up and saying, and it was all a dream.
Yeah, yeah. So in the beginning, he's like, hey, don't take this too seriously as my confession of heaven and hell. Then he talks a lot about heaven and hell.
Yeah, and about then how this is probably his confession about heaven and hell.
And then, at the end, it's kind of like, well, was that real? Sort of thing. And you just have to sort of be careful because you can manipulate it into, because of that, you can manipulate it into whatever you want. You can kind of say, look, this is an allegory about how patient and long-loving God is so that there's really no hell. It's sort of going to be open, and it's telling you about the nature of God. And the other one will be like, it's a classic Christian pilgrim novel about the struggles of getting closer to heaven and sanctification and things like that. It's, I think, just much more complicated in that it's sort of a creative envisioning of the distance between heaven and hell and the Christian's sort of reality as totally saved and yet that sort of waiting distance. And again, you just have to be careful about reading in there. And then the Screwtape Letters are entertaining. Lots of Christians will be enamored with them because they're funny. The little stories in there are funny. I do think there is a temptation to go, you know, read that, and then for the next month, because it was funny and you related to it, going like, every time something bad happens to you or you've made the wrong decision, like, oh, there's my little devil. Just
I think is interesting is that the devil tries to get the person through sins that aren't the obvious sins, mm-hmm. and those are the most effective.
Right.
It kind of reminds me of that movie, The Devil's Own, where Keanu Reeves and Al Pacino,
yeah,
where they end up, you know, they end up not getting the Keanu Reeves character in the end, but there's kind of a restart, and instead of trying him with, what did he try him with? Greed in the first time, mm-hmm. he's going to now do a restart and try him with pride.
Yeah, so I think those are both good because of the sort of indefinite answers about the Christian life. And the sort of the living in a reality where one is totally justified on account of Christ, but life keeps on going. I think that is reflective in both works, as sort of the outside and the inside battles between that reality and where things are headed. Adam, you got anything?
Well, all the above, but I'm going to say Scott turned me on to this last time. I've mentioned already in this episode, but his sermon, The Weight of Glory, is a bit esoteric. Is not the right word, but it's very interesting at first. But there's a bit towards the end. I think it's the last two paragraphs is just pretty. I think encapsulates the you know the burden Christians feel towards their neighbor. And it just, Lewis's prose is just so incredible. But in that volume, there's a bunch of essays. Being the academic, I mean, we're all academics here, but being in an academic institution and
being the real academic.
Right. The Weight of Glory has an essay called Membership, which is fascinating. It's where Lewis refers to democracy as a legal, what is it, a useful fiction or something like that.
That's, I mean,
he goes after. He says it's necessary, but it's silly to place your hope in democracy or something.
To believe
like that
you don't end up in an oligarchy anyway.
Yeah, and then another collection of essays I know they title it something different in the UK. Here it's, I think, typically found under the title God in the Dock.
Yeah.
A lot of great theological, semi-theological, apologetic essays in there.
Bigger collection, too.
Yeah. And there is one, I imagine we have a few, if not more than a few, students who listen to us. There's a great essay in there entitled something like On Learning During Wartime.
Oh, yeah.
That goes into what we might call the vocation of student. And
yeah.
I was going to say, if you're a student listening to this and you sort of need to pad the footnotes of any paper, you might open God in the Dock because your professor might go, very well read.
Yeah, and there's a lot of topics covered.
Yeah, and there's a lot of topics covered. So, yeah, and they're all listed as individual essays. So you could, you could pad the footnotes with three different essays from one book in there. So.
Did you read his essay?
I never did that, by the way.
In Weight of Glory on Punitive Punishment. Because he talks about sort of the fashion of his time with re-education, not punishment, and how silly it was. That even down to, you think that some kind of forced re-education isn't punishment of a kind? That's great.
Funny. Well, guys, we hit time once again. These episodes go by quickly. So I think as I'm thinking through our plans for the next couple episodes, I think it might be good for the next episode to simply be on the Inklings. What was the Inklings? What was the meeting of Inklings? Sort of friendship again, to then get back to another topic from last episode, and then can help us transition to talking about a handful of other individuals from that group.
I think
you guys like that?
I like it.
Thank you for listening to the Thinking Fellows podcast, a production of the 1517 Podcast Network. You can go to 1517.org/podcast to see not only the Thinking Fellows, but all of our shows there. You can also generally search the 1517 website for topics of all shapes and sizes, theological and sort of engaging with culture and ideas. And so we have blogs, videos, podcasts there. And if you have been impacted by the show and would like to support the 1517 Podcast Network, you can go to 1517.org/donate to help us out. We appreciate listening to the show. We will catch you next week. Bye.